Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. Today's guest for Spirit in Action is Daniel Hunter. More than a decade ago, I interviewed Daniel about a book he had written. And when I saw the article he had written just before this past November's election called 10 Things to Do If Trump Wins, I knew it was something I needed to check out. After all, Daniel has done organizing and training in a number of settings in the U.S. and abroad, preparing folks to effectively make this a better world. He's written several books about climate resistance and ending racism, and a choose-your-own-adventure-style book called What Will You Do If Trump Wins? By the way, there is a full uncut version of this program on northernspiritradio.org, where you'll get another 5 or 6 minutes of my interview with Daniel. He is inspirational, engaging, and thoughtful, and he joins us today via Zoom to help equip us all for a challenging future. Daniel, it's great to have you here today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
2013 was when we were last together. At that point, we were interviewing about Strategy and Soul, a campaigner's guide to fighting billionaires, corrupt officials, and Philadelphia casinos. The only thing that's changed is the casinos, I think, right now.
We are still up against an oligarchy and some billionaires who are trying to tell us what to do, yes.
And people can go to NordenSpiritRadio.org, and if you search for Daniel Hunter, you'll find that interview. It's well worth reading that book. Even now, I think the kind of creativity that you used in that campaign against the casinos was so inspiring to me. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years, and that stands out very strongly, the kind of creativity and energy. And it has to be for the long haul, and the long haul just got longer, I think, with current situations. What have you been doing before you started ramping up this organization for post-inauguration? What have you been doing before you shifted to that energy?
So for the last 10 years, I devoted my work to been working at 350.org. So working specifically as a global trainings director, where because climate change is such a major issue and it's a global issue, it's one that we're all experiencing, we're all suffering underneath, and that will be more and more true as these climatic changes are afoot. I wanted to support organizing and activism around it. And 350 is a global organization, so in over 100 countries. My work was getting to support other activists, training them, developing training infrastructure across the globe so that there would be lots of pockets of resistance. Because while it may feel lonely here in the U.S., because we don't pay a lot of attention to the rest of the globe, there are many, many, many people all over fighting on climate change. And so we are not alone. They know that we're up against a very tough regime now, and they see that. And that means they have to redouble their efforts. They get that. But it also means there's a lot of sympathy and empathy from the rest of the globe about what we're facing. And we're not facing something entirely unique. Other people are also facing repressive regimes that are supported by the billionaire class and the oligarchs, and who are also organized based on a right-wing populism of an extremism. And so there are other dynamics like that that we're seeing in other parts of the globe. So there's both lessons that they can share with us, and there's also a bigger world of solidarity that we're in.
Now, the article that you wrote recently, 10 Things to Do Now That Trump Has Won, when did that actually start? When did you actually write that and start conceiving of that? Because I think that was much of a year ago.
So maybe about a year ago, it became clear to me that Trump was a real possibility of winning. And something that happened, folks may recall, there's a head down, imagine it won't happen, et cetera. And so there's a real flat-footedness 8 years ago when Trump won. And many organizations hadn't made game plans about how will we move in these times. And so there's a lot of anxiety and even depression and concern and rapid response. So I thought to myself, it would be helpful if we don't replicate that again by game planning out what happens if Trump wins. So we began running these scenario planning sessions where we would bring colleagues and friends and different comrades to get together, and just people would play different roles. Some people in the military, some people Trump and MAGA, some people entrenched in government, some people would be activist citizens, etc. And began playing out what were some of the different dynamics that would unfold. And the first one, I'll just be totally honest with you. The first one, at the end of it, is a 2-hour session. at the end of it, I was exhausted at a level that I don't remember being in quite some time. And the psychological impact of just walking through what we are going to walk through is huge. And so I think first we just realized the psychological dynamic, that the care that we have to do to each other is just really big. The second thing that we noticed was the response of the activists, and that by and large, this first round that we ran the exercise, activists attempted a lot of social persuasion, getting people to sign petitions or getting celebrities to do sign-on letters or telling politicians to don't do that thing or organizing our people to show up at a rally where many of us would go and say, we're not happy about this thing. MAGA didn't care about any of those things. They did not get in the gears of the system. They did not slow it down. And in fact, many of them, especially the mass rallies, became opportunities for counter-protesting, for violence to occur. And that would then create some, tipped off some cycles of fear-based action. And then the second thing was an incredible amount of denial from our people who were, well, okay, they can't do another thing. And then MAGA would come up with another over-the-top behavior. I think those two things became important notes for us to track of what are some of the different behaviors that we would need to support in that time. So over the last couple of months after that, we began doing more and more of those. We start to train people specifically about what are some different methods that become useful. And so we began talking about non-cooperation and some of the things we'll talk about in this conversation. And also trying to urge people away from just actions that are public angsting or symbolic actions. Because when we're dealing with a more entrenched regime, those actions will have increasing inefficiency in terms of being able to actually move. They may feel good as a kind of action at the moment, but they are largely dead ends in the face of a Trump administration. So you asked the question, how did I write this article? So the article that I wrote, 10 Things to Do If Trump Wins, I wrote 3 days before Trump won. I thought, like many of us, there might be a week or two of counting ballots afterwards. And obviously that wasn't the case. So we very quickly renamed the article to be right onto the times. But I think it was the accumulation of 8 months of preparation and tracking and having conversations with different people, coalitions. I was in rooms with military talking through what they were thinking. And it was a fascinating thing for a peace activist like myself to be engaged with.
You keep referring to we, and I'm assuming you're not referring to 350.org, maybe Waging Nonviolence. Who are you referring to?
We loosely call ourselves Around the Choose Democracy. So it was a project of Choose Democracy. The book that came out of it was a What If Trump Wins, which is a choose your own adventure to kind of explore, to help people move away from just all the bad things will happen, but also what are the things you want to do and how those may influence the macro political system. So how, just as regular folks, the tiny things that we do that may add up. We created the book. That was a team of myself as a writer and Elizabeth Baer, who is the artist, who just did a phenomenal amount of work to make that issue come through. And then again, with the article, that was a collaboration with Waging Nonviolence and the team at Choose Democracy.
If people want to become part of this energy, I mean, I know we have to organize locally. I know we have to connect with community right around us. But is Choose Democracy someone they should be contacting? Who should they be linking into to be part of the larger network?
One of the things that we're doing at Choose Democracy, feel free to join an email. We're trying to help articulate to people what we see in the larger fabric. We're constantly pointing out resources of here's what other people are doing. Siempre in North Carolina is doing great. They just created a great resource on immigrant rights to help people who are plugging in on that issue. There's a group that's created the Resistance Guidebook. We're going to put all this on our website on just whatiftrumpwins.org or on choosedemocracy.us. But what we've done is put a lot of those resources out there that other people are creating in these times so that we can kind of track some of the different resources that are out there.
I want to come back to the two things that you said that you experienced when you were first enacting these scenarios. I think we should have learned from the first term of Donald Trump, and I think we didn't, that he doesn't care about democracy in the sense that most of us think of it. That, in fact, he thinks he should have all the power to do whatever he wants. Supreme Court has now accorded him more leeway than we've ever thought of having a president having before. And he just believes he gets to say whatever he says. If he doesn't get it, he'll have a tantrum and he'll make people do it somehow. He's even been talking about using the military within the United States to take out his enemies. So the idea that all we need to do is get someone to vote on something seems pretty naive in the face of his stated intentions. When he states that, well, I'll be a dictator on day one. Does anyone really think that it's only going to be day one?
Well, I mean, people use the analogy of the frog in the pot, right? The story of those increasing things. And I think in some ways, I want to start at a different place, which is not just our analysis of Trump, but our analysis of ourselves. I've been very influenced by Hannah Arendt, who's done a lot of writing about autocracies. And one of the things that she's sort of written about, and autocracy isn't the exact word that she's using a lot, but the dynamic of an autocracy or dictatorship or whatever you have you, a big piece of it is there's a breakdown, a social breakdown. And the reason that someone who's over the top, who has simple answers for complex problems gets attractive, I think has to do with the amount of fear and anxiety that's out there. There are big problems out there. Climate change, you name it. There are huge problems out there that there don't seem to be clear answers for. There don't seem to be the political motion to make them happen. We seem intractable on these various conflicts, whether they could be solvable or not, but they feel intractable. They feel like we're not moving in the right direction. And so people look for something. And so one thing people look for is they can go towards very simplified answers. And for some people, that feels like Trump because he can provide X, Y, or Z simplified things of the strong man. And this is not a unique phenomenon to the U.S. Strong men are getting elected, chosen by their people across the globe because I think there's something inside that people aren't tending to, a kind of fear for the moment. So one place to start, and this is where I start in the article, is I think the first place to start is really just trusting yourself because there's a lot of social distrust. And so being a person who's trustworthy, being a person who trusts your own instincts, we don't know what's going to happen. I'm not saying that we trust in with a kind of certainty of our analysis of the correct one, but instead about believing in your eyes and your gut, what you're seeing. So when you're being told that Trump's going to be a dictator just on day one, and your gut says something different, go with your gut here and stop questioning it. Go with it. Because it becomes crazy making, I think, if we continue to constantly internalize sort of the messages that are coming from the outside. I think that's just a place to start. And you asked another question, which is where to plug in. And I think the second step here is to really connect with other people who you trust. And I do believe a lot of organizing initially is really about local affinity-based local-based organizing, not just because that's where mass movements will emerge from, that has always been true, but it's also the case that we need your people around us to be brave. When we're alone, it's much easier to be scared. Prisons know this. That's why if you want a prisoner to be scared, you put them into solitary confinement, because people do not do well when we're on our own. And so when we're instead in formation, connected with other people that we trust. And so if you haven't yet post-election called all your people in for some gatherings or meetings in your house or whatnot, this is a fantastic moment for that, to just be with each other and to connect so that we're building some base of people to encourage each other to be brave and bold and say we have each other's backs, to show that we love each other, to create these kinds of connections. That's the model out of Chile. Chile, which is experiencing vastly more extreme dictatorship than we have, I think, even in our worst imagination at the moment here during the 70s and 80s, the dictatorship just shut down everything. It was to the point where people were scared to just even say their names to other people. And so social connection became so important. So that's why they organized through affinity group model. Tiny groups of people, nodes, who would get together. They would do quick actions together, sometimes in public, sometimes in private institutions. But they would be a place to act from. And I think that affinity group model is a natural way for us in these times to connect and form. And a lot of people have done that already. You don't have to call it affinity group, but knowing it as such may be helpful. So some people to regularly touch base with.
Let me ask you a couple questions, Daniel, about those first two. I read the article. I'm very impressed with it, and I think you're spot on in each of these points. A lot of people may not actually understand how right you are or understand in which way you're right. So the first one, trust yourself. A lot of people right now are still saying, oh, it can't be that bad. So I don't know if that's denying themselves. Is that trusting themselves, or I trust that things will be okay? I trust the American people will make out right. At this point, that seems to me naive denial. So maybe I'm asking them not to trust themselves. I don't know. Could you address that complex question? Because, you know, you can start with a tiny bit that you know inside you, but when you go to the society, you have to have ways to determine what you're knowing.
I mean, we're Quaker, and I think one aspect of trust is not just integrity is another word for this, which is none of us have certainty about what will happen. And in fact, I think that part of the anxiety of this moment is how extreme will it be? How wild will it be? Will he use the military for this or that? Which things are posturing? And we don't know that. And so I think a level of healthy skepticism about our own beliefs. But trust is different. I'm using trust more than just trusting your political analysis, but also leaning into your own inner wisdom, your own inner guide, and being back in touch with that. I can pretty much guarantee for all of your listeners that, like, when we're on Facebook scrolling or on whatever social medium scrolling, we lose touch with that inner grounded thing of ourselves that is about being trustworthy. And instead, we get caught up in other people's opinions or our insecurities or uncertainties, as opposed to this more grounded position. And the old Quakers used to use the phrase to stay low. When I hear that phrase, I think a little bit about, it's not about everything I believe is true. It's not that version of trust. It's coming back to my own center and returning to the things that I know to be most true. And I'll say this a different way, which is, when I asked a lot of people, I've talked to thousands of people in the last couple of weeks, when I've asked people what they've been up to in this time post-election, regularly they're telling me they're spending more time with people they love. They're spending more time either in nature or spending less time reading the news. These are healthy behaviors, as I think people are searching for more of that inner center. So that's what I'm naming, is you really do have to protect yourself. One of my colleagues described it this way. He said, if you don't have an energy practice or a spiritual practice or prayer practice in this time, you're going to be really out to lunch. So this is the moment to get that so that you can be a trustworthy body.
Your step two is about finding others who you trust. I've got several groups. I've got two different men's groups I meet with each week. We trust each other deeply, right? I'm part of the Quaker meeting. I'm part of a folk dance group. I mean, there's a whole number of people who I trust, but our society actually works to militate against trust. And once you spend time on Facebook, people take pot shots at each other, do things they would never do face to face, right? But our society economically has militated to isolate people. Don't ask your neighbor for an egg. You can order it online at this place, etc. How do you resist those great tidal waves of energy of our society, which really tell us to invest out there, Facebook or Amazon or whatever?
You just named it. You just got to do it by doing it. You know what I mean? I mean, you're expressing the challenge, which is, it's easy to identify the things that Trump tells us to do to divide people up, right? Telling people to distrust. The list is long, right? Democrats, people who are socialists, people who live in Philly, people who have female bodies, people who, I mean, on and on and on. People who are trans, people who are from Mexico, people who are immigrants, people who are undocumented. I mean, right? But that's in the culture. That's not a unique phenomena. I mean, parts of it are unique, no question. But it's not a unique phenomena. And so resisting it takes at least identifying who are the next tier of people outside of the people. When you say your we, you ask me who's my we. When you ask who's your we, what's the next tier outside of that? And to be more inclusive, that those are also your people. Those are also your neighbors. In this moment, I'm reminded of Mr. Rogers, who I think people have watched his movies that recently about him that have come out a couple of years ago, I think can be a kind of symbol of neighborliness as a spiritual practice, that was a thing that he was holding and doing for all of us, and that's a different way of operating. We may not be in shape to extend it fully, widely, unconditionally, but it's the constant expansion of that. We have a bigger we. And to be intentional about that, that our intention is to grow the we of people. And so trust doesn't mean that someone won't violate it, that someone won't hurt us, that someone won't. But it means that we get less lonely, less isolated, as we're in touch with other people and willing to forgive and connect and so forth. And so distrust is a pattern, and we have to interrupt it, because otherwise it gets harder to organize a society, to connect with other people, to we miss allies because they didn't say it the way we wanted them to say it, or because they didn't say it in the moment that we needed it, wanted them to say it. And I think behaviors that continue that disconnection are assisting the oligarchs. That's what their primary aim is. We can control a population if they're at each other's throats.
You mentioned earlier about how Pinochet did his process of ruling Chile. People were unwilling to talk to one another. You've had experience beyond the U.S. borders with dictators, with autocrats, with people who are taking over control of countries, places where you fought. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo in West Africa, which was a dictatorship, still is. I got to see how that looks on the ground. And I think a lot of Americans really simply do not understand that living in a dictatorship doesn't mean that you know you're living in a dictatorship. This is our president. That's what the term was used for Yadema, who was the ruler in Togo back then. People would joyfully stand up whenever he needed support, right? He did that in terms of we love Togo. But in fact, I saw one of the teachers at my school and another one that I didn't know firsthand who were hauled away because in a regional teachers meeting, they had raised a question about corruption in government, and he disappeared for a week. And he came back and never could say a word about what happened to himself. But most people in Togo, I think, weren't thinking they were under a dictatorship. Although, when I mentioned in class, the first month I was in Togo, I mentioned something about how the government shouldn't do this, interrupting class so that we can go cheer for a government official who's coming to town. I had students come to me and said, yeah, you should be careful because something can happen. So what's your experience with actual autocrats, dictatorships, places where people have had to be leery of the government in that way?
Very similar to yours. A major dynamic that shows up living under an autocratic regime is it becomes harder and harder to analyze your own situation. And you named a particular aspect of that that I'm really glad you did, which is that gentleman who came back, the teacher who came back, who then couldn't tell their story. They had experienced some amount of pain, we don't know what, but there wasn't a spot to then unhook the emotion so that they could do grief. That grief becomes interrupted. In South Africa, what did the government do as it was trying to shut down anti-apartheid protests? It would shut down funerals because those were interrupting grief cycles, rituals of community mourning. I think there's two ways, there's many different ways to interrupt it. In fact, there's compartmentalizing, rationalizing, intellectualizing. One of the ways that I've noticed people avoiding grief is one direction is, I just can't believe it's going to happen like this, or I can't believe he's doing that, which is not accepting reality as it's currently happening. So as over the next couple of months, years, as we watch Trump making moves, it's going to be very important that when he says he might do something, we consider that that really might happen. And that's going to reduce our ability to just say, I can't believe. And that piece is important for us. A second aspect that I've been noticing is people also doing avoidance, and this happens in other places, by making up a story that it's already lost far before it is, and acting as if they then are accepting by saying he doesn't honor the law anyway, so it's not going to happen. In a way, shooting down activists who are attempting to say, we could make a better world by doing this, that, or the other thing. Both of them aren't actually dealing with the emotional load that dictators put on people. Now, I'll just give a specific example. In Zimbabwe, I remember watching election after election that Mugabe would run. Mugabe was just held told tight to the country. He would run elections, and Zimbabweans would say to me, I think we're going to be able to win this one. And they would have a reason. They think the opposition party was better organized or we're more prepared or something. And it's not my country. I didn't know better than them. So I just listened to them. But I said, do you really think that's going to happen? Or do you think he's just going to steal it again? Doesn't that seem like what he's been doing? I said, no, I think this time it's for real. And what I realized is that one aspect of living under one situation that where your hope, your political hope is fractured so many times is you start just putting it anywhere. You start putting your hope in pathways that clearly would not have. And so Mugabe would steal the election again and they would say, oh, that's devastating. But then a few years later, Mugabe would announce a new round of elections and people would say, well, this time. And they would keep investing energy in a new thing that wasn't likely to happen at all. So I think the alternative to some of that is just acknowledging. I feel a little soft here. I'm a strategist by nature, but a lot of what I'm laying out are emotional, psychological things. But a lot of the territory of autocracy is psychology. That's why they took that person away and then scared them, because that teacher then scares everybody else. By not even knowing the story, it becomes even more scary because you and me have now imagined, and all of your listeners have imagined what happened to them, and we don't even know. And that makes it worse. But if they just said this thing, and they work through their feeling state, and we're able to name, right? That's what gets taken away, is our power to name our own life experience, own it. And so we're going to need to do a lot of naming our life experiences, what we're experiencing from the Trump administration, what we're worried about, what we're scared about, being sad together. And that's part of that, why we need that community of people to see other aspects of our feeling states that we haven't even noticed, but that we can begin to honor all of those things internally, grief, crying, holding people, breathing, all those kinds of things. That becomes an important element. It doesn't have to be public. That can be part of the public discourse as well. I mean, that's often powerful. Movements are able to express untold stories, but that at least we need to be able to do it with ourselves, with our own people. So before we even get to strategizing or list making or planning or those kind of things, some place where we're releasing some of those feelings.
Again, folks, we're visiting with Daniel Hunter. Article he put out right before and after, it was revised after Trump won, is 10 things to do now that Trump has won. You can track him down. I've got several different links that are on northernspiritradio.org where you can see the full article of the 10 points he makes. And we're adding more color to that, but there's some that we're not going to talk about. We're not just reading the article by any means. ChooseDemocracy.us, WhatIfTrumpWins.org. are two of the places you might want to go. But what's really going to be important is the folks in your area who are engaging for this. So please follow up with those. A little bit more about your experience, Daniel, is that you've been consulting with, training with, working with people in places like Burma or Sierra Leone. I don't know if you had anything to do with Syria. The change that has happened in Syria could be exciting or scary as it is. Getting rid of one dictator doesn't guarantee that you're not just going to go down a deeper hole like Egypt did. So do you have experience in Burma or Sierra Leone that's applicable to what we're doing here in the U.S. right now, what we're entering into?
Yeah, I mean, you've named a really important piece, which is visioning what happens afterwards. So that it's one thing to have an opposition party. So folks in Serbia, for example, who were involved in overthrowing Milosevic, they weren't only a direct action wing pushing on non-cooperation, but they were also trying to figure out how can we also insert an alternative structure. Both those things are really important. And so one of the ways I've written about this in the book and elsewhere has been starting to kind of understand there's different roles for the next couple of years for us to kind of track. Some of us will be doing protection work. And so in any of the places that I've worked, there's always people who are identifying people who are in immediate need and offering them help. So whether they're trans, whether they're immigrants, whether they're, you know, having abortions, et cetera, those are going to be people that we'll need. And that's a role that some of us will be called to. And another one is defending civic institutions from attack. And so my colleagues in Turkey, years ago, I had the opportunity to listen to one of my colleagues give a talk about what does the U.S. need to learn from Turkey. And the first thing she did is she got up and she said, you need to protect your media. If you do not have an active, vibrant, alternative media, it will get very hard quickly. And that was her primary message, was as they watched the media get destroyed in their country, it became much, much, much harder to source out quality information, to actually track what was happening in other regions and other places, and to get intel about what's really happening with the government. Because instead, they were just hearing government rhetoric more and more, and it became harder to track what was going on. So some people will be involved in that aspect of it, which is defending civic institutions. So knowing those aren't, they're not perfect. And that's not a body of work that personally I feel called to do. I don't think I have the patience to protect bureaucracies. But EPA is going to be on the chopping block, education department, the U.S. military, local institutions, local election systems. If we want to keep as fair elections as we had, we're going to need to defend that. So that body of work is one avenue for people. So protecting people, defending civic institutions. And then the work that I'm more familiar with is groups who are doing the disrupt and disobey. That's often the people I've been supporting in other places. I think they have a ton to teach us because we have gotten to see a lot of people in this era pushing back against right-wing populists. And I think some of the things that they're teaching us has been, like in Korea, where they've just engaged in a big push against their government through mass non-cooperation and through a polarized society, with some set of people absolutely supporting the current regime and others saying, we don't want this. What's been interesting about that dynamic has been mass non-cooperation doesn't start at mass level. And that's a good memo for us to really get in our heads. It doesn't start at an effective level. Mass-on cooperation, the theory behind it is when we reach a tipping point where enough of us are no longer willing to go along with the current regime, no matter what it wants to do, it cannot keep that up because Trump doesn't do anything. And I mean this in a very literal sense. Trump doesn't wash windows. He doesn't build roads. He doesn't milk cows. He doesn't run the internet. He doesn't build websites. People do these things. And when people refuse to do these things in large numbers, then it becomes unstable. And that's the theory of non-cooperation. But a bunch of people would have to try that out. And typically, they will not be successful in dismantling or disrupting the regime. They may take a portion to target. So rather than targeting the whole enchilada, they'll target what's sometimes known as like castles of reform, parts of the reform that are minor pieces that destabilize. So, for example, I've just been in conversations with some people of faith who've been talking about doing tax resistance as a possible option if things get dire. They said, as moral people, we would have trouble continuing to support a US government if it is ordering its military against its own people. So, that's a position. And then that conversation starts to go to other people inside the establishment of the city level who started also having conversations about what if the city gets pushed by Trump? And Trump says to the city of Philadelphia, I'm not going to give you money anymore because I don't like your policies on immigration or how you're treating your neighbors.
Or to LA, you're not going to get money unless you change these policies about gays or environmental or whatever.
Or whatever wildfire thing we are trying to pretend to happen. So then it becomes a chance where the city could then say, we're not going to continue to collect money and send it to the federal government until you change policy. And until that point, we're withholding our taxes as a city. And so that's how those things escalate. And I say this for this reason. Even if you're not into mass non-cooperation at this moment in time, that's fine. There will likely be opportunities to join in the future. And one thing that will assist those of us who are supporting the disrupt and disobey strategy is to not test whether or not we've been effective at the whole enchilada, but instead, whether or not other people are ready to join some of the different tactics and to look and be on the lookout for other tactics to join. Because it's not going to work if we all have to come to some big consensus moment and we're all in easy agreement. We're going to have to join some things that we're a little uncomfortable with, but it's going to get approximately where we need to get to. So I'm saying that I think prefiguratively that we're not there in non-cooperation for mass non-cooperation, but we may indeed have to get there. And one reason we may have to get there is if the traditional institutions don't work out, if elections aren't able to kick them out in 4 years, or if elections don't even run in 2 years or whatnot, and we don't know. I'm just joining that area of we don't know. Non-cooperation is the strategy. So in autocracies, non-cooperation becomes a key pathway. Tax resistance, national strikes, work shutdowns, other kinds of mass disobedience tactics are the ones that are actually the most effective to displace an authoritarian. And then I'll just say the last piece, just because I'm on the roll there. So I've talked about protecting people, defending civic institutions, and then disrupting and disobeying. Those are three different pathways. And the fourth is building alternative. And I would say this is the one that we may need the most love for, because if we're going to get better democracy than whatever we've had in this past version, in order to become a better version of this, we have to really engage. Some people have to really engage in some deep thinking about what kinds of systems will work for the people that live in the United States. What are some systems that will help reshape and reform so that we can come back together in some ways? And those are a different set of the disruption and disobeying people. We're building on cooperation to stop a thing. But as Syria and many countries have shown, simply removing a figurehead, a dictatorial figurehead, without some structural reforms means you have not solved the problem. Trump is not the problem. Trump is merely a symptom of the situation that we're in, of the moment of history in the US empire that we're in. So that whole world of building alternatives is so critical to help us get beyond just we got to reform the Electoral College, but something that makes our hearts sing. And that's the world of parallel institutions and alternative party platforms, the growth of third party institutions, or new culture building, that realm. I also want to honor of rich cultural work that prepares us for a different kind of society than the one that we're in now.
And what Daniel Hunter is talking about and his 10 points that he sent out about what we need to do now that Trump has been reelected is number five, find your path. I want to talk a little bit more about that. But first, folks, I want to remind you, you are listening to Spirit in Action. For 20 years now, we've been bringing Spirit in Action and Song of the Soul to you via Northern Spirit Radio. NorthernSpiritRadio.org is our website. We're on some 35 stations nationwide, but a whole lot of podcast places. And you look for Spirit in Action, Song of the Soul on those different platforms, and you'll be able to listen to us weekly that way. But Daniel Hunter is here because he's been organizing for a long time now. And there's an earlier interview I did with him back in 2013. If you come to NorthernSpiritRadio.org and search for Daniel Hunter, you'll find that interview. And you'll get some more ideas about the creative ways that we can make a difference. Unfortunately, there's so many of us who think there's something bad going on. What I want to do is have a rally. And it's not that rallies are in themselves bad, but it may be a loss of our energy towards something much more valuable. I'll have Daniel say a little bit more about that. But just keep in mind, all of those links for those programs for the past 20 years are on NorthernSpiritRadio.org. We love two-way communications. And one of the points that Daniel's already talked about is we have to find those we trust. And we have to be open to communication. We have to learn together. We have to build community together. So please, when you visit, post a comment. Let us know what you're thinking. Suggest who we should be talking to. I'm not doing this alone. I'm only able to do this because of your support. And I view myself as part of this alternative media that we need to get out to the rest of the world. So please support us. There's a way you can donate. So please do help us out. Again, all these links to all of my guests the past 20 years are on NorthernSpiritRadio.org. So follow those people. People like George Lakey. I found the link to your article, Daniel, via something that George sent out. He pointed me at a couple other ones. Just excellent sources. We need the best minds working together, because one of the things that's going to happen, folks, is they'll take down one or two point people. They'll somehow remove them, put them in house arrest, and take them off the internet. And unless we have, as a community, banded together, we will lose our energy. So please, you're a vital part of whatever gets done. Just keep that in mind. Your point six was, do not obey in advance. Do not self-censor. I think this may be really hard for people who are used to nurturing our society. The way we get along is go with the flow. And maybe the kind of organizers that you're looking for will not be self-censoring, will not be giving up in advance. But your other point, you say, is don't fight the battles that can't be won. I don't think you use those exact words, but talk about what that means for you and why is that important?
I want to just give a direct footnote here out loud, which is that phrase, do not self-censor, I took directly from Timothy Snyder, who wrote a book called On Tyranny. And it's a fantastic series. There's a book, he made a video series out of it. But his first number one thing out of the gate, he said, let me see if I can remember this quote. Most of authoritarian is freely given. It's not taken. In times of, I don't remember the phrase, in times like these and something like that, individuals think ahead about what the government wants, what the authoritarian wants, and they give it freely. Without asking, without being challenged about it. And so what he's analyzing is, and this is across the board around authoritarian regimes, which is as they begin to grow, people, one tip off will often be jokes people say. Oh, don't sign that thing because you'll be on a list. Oh, the CIA is on your case. That's why the phone is da 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 da. And those become signifiers of the culture that we're imagining, and imagining a culture that's tracking us and watching us. And we're now seeing our own selves through the eyes of the authoritarian regime, not as free people, but instead beginning to think about that. And then we make choices to say, oh, actually, I won't do that because I don't want to get on a list, even though there might not be a list. In fact, there often isn't a list. I mean, this government is not a well-coordinated machine, this incoming administration. It is messy. It is blurry. It is not clear what they want to do. They are at each other. They are combative with each other. I'm not saying many other things aren't also true, that they might be very effective, but that they are not a well-coordinated machine. And yet we ascribe to them a level of sophistication and coordination and that they've already tracked CIA and so forth. So I note that, and there's been actions that we've already seen. I think we could note, like, Washington Post and the LA Times early on when they refused to endorse a candidate in the presidential race while it was still going. That was classic self-censorship. They made a choice to not pick a fight with someone that they were worried might do something. And so that avoiding of a fight means that the political space shrunk a little bit that day. As individuals, we may not have a lot of decisions about what the Washington Post or the LA Times does, though we can tell our annoyance to them about it. But that we also have political space. What do we say? What do we not say because we're worried about what others might ascribe to us or so forth? Again, I'm not saying to people that you can't make choices to self-protect or keep your job or, you know, make choices. I'm a big fan of that. But to be really conscious of the degrees to which we start to shrink our own political space without anyone asking us, without ever being told, and instead to keep pushing back against that. Because the lesson is this, is political space that you don't use, you lose.
And I saw this happen in Daniel when I was in Togo. It's not only the person who came back from being removed for a week by the police. It was also Peace Corps volunteers who had to be careful what they said. So I looked what I would say in class, and without talking down the government, I found a way I could talk about, well, here's how we do it in the U.S. I could set up that ideal and create the tension. So even when you perceive that something is going to happen, and by the way, I knew a Peace Corps volunteer who had written something home in very jazzed up English that she figured the censors would not get because we knew all of our mail was read coming and going. She wrote something to her mother that criticized something that was done by a government official. And she got hauled away by the police and deported from Togo the next day. So it can happen.
It can happen. That's right.
But they count on the fact that you're not going to say anything critical. So when there was an assassination attempt, a coup attempt on the dictator in Togo while I was there, everybody had to go out in the cities and march down saying, oh, we love our president. And they were doing it half-heartedly, but they also had to set up an enemy that people could sacrifice, if you will. So the signs they were carrying in my village were down with colonists. And I looked around in my village where everybody else was black except me. And I said, I wonder who that's referring to. But even though I didn't think their hearts were fully in it, I think they were going along with what the government wanted them to do. And it's very easy to fall into and give up the struggle before it actually happens. It's probably good to make them work for their victories, too, when you've got a dictator you're facing down. Now, did you see that kind of thing in Burma or other places where you've had firsthand contact with?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you've mentioned a couple of different stories, and I could go examples with that in Burma, too, where Burma instituted a vast system of networks of spies. And how vast it was began to be, as over the years, I think, more and more inflated. Because it doesn't take a lot of political repression to scare a lot of people to not keep speaking up. And so something in this moment, where we don't have an entrenched repressive regime to that extent, it becomes particularly important. And we would say the same things for folks in Burma. I won't make a distinction here, but that the story was still very similar, which is in the U.S., we don't have such an advanced regime for capturing repression, though it certainly is live and active, but that we have a responsibility then to push against that and to conscientiously and continuously push against these things. But some of that's also attitudinal. And so here I'm thinking about, like, in Serbia, I mentioned that. So in Serbia, OPPOR as an organization, they had a very particular relationship to police violence and police brutality that happened against them. And one option for them was they could tell the story and tell how horrific it was and accentuate that story. And they went a different direction, which was to minimize it by making jokes about it. It doesn't hurt so much when you're scared. And they would really do the kind of minimizing thing. And the story they told instead was, the more you hurt us, the more our movement grows. And that became the story they would keep telling. And one example of that was, just to kind of make that point, on New Year's Eve, they had a big celebration march in the middle of the street in Belgrade. They had a big celebration, big rock party. People were playing music. Then at 12 o'clock, they counted down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then they shut the music off and they said, there's no party. We're going to go home and next year, we're going to bring down this regime. We're not going to give in to their repression. They've been beating us up, but we're not going to give in to it. That's a statement. That's an attitude that they were promoting and presenting. It's very Gandhian in some ways. Gandhi wasn't about trying to avoid the repression. Gandhi was saying the repression itself will actually be part of the thing that we will use as energy, because people will see how wrong it is, and that will become part of the impetus to continue resisting. And so rather than walking away from oppression or trying to push it down, He embraced and engaged with that repression. That does mean cost and sacrifice. There's cost and sacrifice in this equation, no question. And for all of us, we will have internal questions of at what level and when. And I'm a father of a six-year-old kid and want to think about what that means. And so there will be questions for us to analyze and understand. But the piece around where we're heading, we have to tell the story that we're not going to be scared by the intimidation. Therefore, when a repressive thing happens, when a political violence thing happens, the story isn't let's freeze in the face of Proud Boys in our streets and get scared and then tell each other that means we're not going to go into the streets anymore. Instead, we say, grabbing a tactic from another example where they decide to do a fundraiser. Okay, so for every KKK person you see, we'll give $10 to XYZ Black organization. And that became a way to detooth or other folks who show up at Klan rallies as dressed as clowns and to just mock the whole thing, the whole activity. Those are all things that respond to political violence with less fear, which is going to be important for us. And I think in the article, I tell a story from Bayard Rustin, and I do love the story. It's another Quaker. So Bayard Rustin, he had arrived in Montgomery at a very particular time. Montgomery, during its early years of the Montgomery bus boycott, King had just been appointed. He was new to nonviolence theory. Actually, he didn't know anything about nonviolence theory, really. He hadn't been schooled in any of this yet. He was just a pastor who had been appointed because he was unknown, neutral territory.
This is Martin Luther King you're speaking of.
This is Martin Luther King Jr., yeah. And so Dr. King had been, you know, positioned as the leader of the Montgomery Improvement Association, the Montgomery Bus Boycott Organization. And the leaders in Montgomery had dusted off some old antiquated laws, basically targeting the organizers, accusing them of running their own taxi cab company. And so the leaders had kind of gone underground. King had left the city for a period of time, and the rest of the leaders were largely hanging out in their parishioners' homes and otherwise largely hiding out. And Bayard came into the situation. Bayard Rustin was an old Gandhian and had really been just a vibrant organizer. He's young at the time, but he looked at the situation and said, this is not how you want to move. You don't want to be in hiding from this. So he talked to Ralph Abernethy, who is Dr. King's right-hand man, and tried to convince him to face the repression directly. And Ralph Abernethy wouldn't be persuaded. So he went on, he found E.D. Nixon. E.D. Nixon got the memo, understood it. And so E.D. Nixon, with a bunch of his members of his congregation, went down to the police station and they demanded that they get arrested. And so E.D. Nixon came out with his papers held high of, look, you've been arrested, and his citation, and said, I'm in it. And people cheered. And then other people got the memo. And so other pastors and leaders began filing into the police station. And they too began demanding that they get arrested then and there on their terms, right? I'm picturing this, just to say, I'm picturing this as a possible response when Liz Cheney gets arrested, or if Liz Cheney gets arrested, or Adam Kitzinger or someone. But these become moments where we don't shrink. Okay, if you're going to arrest someone as conservative as Liz Cheney, well, then you definitely want me. And so it becomes a moment. And what they did was they transformed the fear that was operating into valor. In fact, some people who were leaders in the Montgomery movement, they showed up, weren't on the list, and they began arguing with the police, you have to arrest me. My people, they'll think less of me if I don't get arrested too with them. So you've got to put me on the list, man. Again, what that does, that makes a different transformation. That's a different relationship to the repression. When we're so scared of it, fear itself is deeply paralyzing. You know, I tell it's a fun story that way, but this becomes an approach that we need to figure out how to keep supporting each other on. And that's why we need affinity groups to help us, stabilize us, people who take care of our kids during those days or weeks that we're in prison, et cetera. But that becomes part of that, because this is new territory, new day.
I think we're up to point 8 or 9 on your 10 things that we have to deal with now. What do you want to mention about the other ones? I know that we have to free you to up more work that you have to be doing.
Well, we've covered a lot of them. The two other pieces that I think are really critical in this time, I think having an understanding of where we are is going to be critical, but having a vision for ourselves of what could be that isn't only dreary. So one thing I did in writing this Choose Your Own Adventure book, which is a fascinating way to write a story for a movement organizer. But I wanted to get people thinking not just what bad things might happen, but also, and then what do you do? You know, there's a series of moves by Trump, and then there's an opportunity for you to think, what do you do? And part of the reason for that is it's not going to be enough if we just vision the reality of bad things happening. It's important that we also spend energy envisioning what kind of future we could imagine coming out of, not just as hyperbole, not just as a exercise, And this, I think I'm led by Octavia Butler, who really engaged with a sort of, if you want to call it an apocalyptic viewpoint, what might be. And where she came to it wasn't a happy-go-lucky society gets saved moment, but was about how society and the individuals around it might be transformed and develop a whole new ethic. And I'll say it personally this way, which is right after the election, I did a series of interviews, right? So this article went very viral. And so I began doing a bunch of different interviews. And one reporter, this is days after the election, one reporter asked me a pretty tricky question. I can't remember the exact framing, but something like, you know, a loaded question like, how do you hope Trump supporters will suffer or get their comeuppance in the time ahead? Which isn't a way that I hold at all. So I had to like step back from the question. And I found myself just taking a breath and remembering the things I know about when you get a loaded question from a reporter is don't rush into it. Take a moment, take a breath. And think to yourself, what is really true that you want to say here? And so, Mark, you know that I'm someone who's been around Quakers for decades. What came out of my mouth, to the shock of me and everyone who heard me, was, look, I'm Quaker. What that means is I believe there's that of God within every person. Therefore, what I'm looking for in this period of time ahead is that each one of us have greater access to the inner divine so that we can be more wise, more kind, and more compassionate for the times ahead. The first, as you can hear in my voice, the last few sentences made perfect sense to me. But I had said way too fast, I'm Quaker. And what I realized as I processed this later was that, I mean, initially I dismissed it. Initially I just thought, oh, I was just stressed and spoke too fast. The next day I got asked almost the same question by another reporter. And I found myself answering the exact same way. Look, I'm Quaker. That means I believe there's that of God within every person. What that means is that I want each of us to have greater access to the inner divine so that we can be more wise, caring, and compassionate in the time ahead. Boom. But what I've noticed among my friends, and I don't know if that's true everywhere, but what I've noticed among my friends and peers and people I've been tracking has been many of us are looking for more faith in these times, sources of grounded spirituality or however we relate to that, but something beyond just this moment. I think that's a important position for us to hold. That's about envisioning a positive future. That's about having a bigger relationship to the world than just reading the news. If we're just going to read the news, we will find no respite. But if we're able to speak to the times or be in some kind of greater connection, greater, whether that's an earth seed connection that we're feeling or whether that's a strong connection to the divine or greater relationship with God, this moment is offering that for many people. And I think that's a healthy thing. I think that's a thing to lean into because just having a vision of direness won't help us with where we are. We also have to lean in. And in fact, I think that's a good way to close because I feel like that really essentializes a lot of these lessons. These are non-cooperation isn't just a, as Gandhi kind of taught it, it wasn't just a mechanical strategic strategy as he did it, but it was also a kind of faith statement about humans can make our conditions better when we act like free people. When we move like a free people do, we will be more free.
Again, point 10 of Daniel Hunter's 10 things to do now that Trump has won is envision a positive future. A lot of people may choose to ignore that in the midst of the fight. As Daniel just pointed out, it's something we need to be moving toward. It's not only what we're resisting, it's what we're moving toward that's going to make all of the difference of where we end up. So please remember to do that. Again, we've been speaking with Daniel Hunter. The article that he released, I'll have a link to it on wagingnonviolence.org. There's other connections you want to get a hold of, choosedemocracy.us, whatiftrumpwins.org. And where is the best place to get your book, Daniel, if we don't want to get it through Amazon?
If you go to whatiftrumpwins.org, you can go through it online. We want people to just use it. So you can go through it online. We do also have a link on the website to be able to order if you want to avoid Amazon through that as well.
Daniel, your work, your deep reflection, the way that you've helped people in our country and in the rest of the world is so influential for me. And I'm significantly older than you are, and I love learning from other people who've put their feet on the path and have walked it steadfastly. And so I am so thankful that you've been doing that work, that you shared this preparation for the coming tribulation, and that you joined me here today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you so much, Mark. I love your engaged mind and your creative questions. They're great. Great chatting with you.
Thanks so much. And again, all those links are NordenSpiritRadio.org. We'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.
With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo.